Welcome everyone to Act in Perspective Podcast, where we talk to people from all walks of life about what's important using behavioral science as our guide to create solutions to some of our more troubling questions we face in humanity. From issues such as chronic pain, race, gender and class disparities, death and dying, adolescence and mental health, education, public policy, politics and religion, we talk about it all. What is important to you is often important to others. We discuss it here, and you're welcome to discuss what you care about in more detail at our website, actinperspective.com, a pro-social network addressing how to make the world a better place. Today, we are joined by Paul Lagerman, a physiotherapist out of Auckland, New Zealand, who has years of experience working with others living with chronic pain and how he applies the acceptance and commitment training or ACT model to his practice, not so much to relieve the pain as much as the suffering often associated with it. Forget about what you think you know about pain. There is much more going on than what we've always been taught. Welcome to ACT in Perspective.
Yeah.
It is rather phallic, is that?
I know, it is. It is, yeah. Yeah, it's often referred, you're talking about the hotel?
Yeah.
It's a famous landmark, and it's always known as a penis hotel. I don't know, it's been around here for a long, long time.
Is this going to be in the podcast?
I don't know. We're recording right now. Who knows?
Great. It's odd. It's a little bit odd here. I say odd. I don't know. I'm speaking to a few people, and there's some reservations actually about getting the vaccine.
Yeah.
Like not to brag, but clearly what seems to be New Zealand has handled it reasonably well. And of course, you know, you can argue that there's only 5 million people and we're not landlocked and all this sort of stuff. And that's fair, you know, fair enough. Yeah. But we have seemed to handle it quite well to the point that I would say we've gone back to, I think we've gone back to around, 75, 80%. There's still plenty of people struggling in this country because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of how we're living, we're living a fairly unrestricted life.
Yeah. I do want to get into that. I do have questions about New Zealand and then how that plays into your job. And what you do. The population, the demographics are completely different in New Zealand compared to the United States. And, so I do want to ask about that, but are you ready to get started? Is that?
Sure.
We essentially have been.
I'm good to go.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Welcome to Action Perspective Podcast, where we reach across the aisle and connect with people from all different walks of life who have adapted the model of acceptance commitment therapy or training, also known as ACT, to use within their own work and practice. And why is this important? It's because if you're not familiar with ACT, it's a flexible behavioral model supported in science that gets to the core processes of how our brains and bodies work with respect to suffering and building a new relationship to suffering with our suffering is at the heart of everything that we do. So today, you are our very first podcast. And so I think that we're going to, we may see some kinks. I don't know. But it's all right. Paul Lagerman. Am I pronouncing that right? Paul Lagerman. So Paul is a physiotherapist with a chunk of OT, occupational therapy, and a twist of psychology with more than 20 years experience working in pain. You live and work in Auckland, New Zealand, which is the Northern Island, right? And it's a beautiful setting right on, you have like two main harbors. It just looks fantastic. You trained as a sports therapist initially, right, in the early 90s, and then became a physiotherapist in the early 2000s. You worked within the field of pain management since you began your physiotherapy career. And then in 2013, you moved from the UK to New Zealand. And now you work as a clinical advisor for a large healthcare company. And then now you're also, your role is to improve or involve mentoring and supervising clients or clinicians in project work. And you also have a blog, right? The Naked Physio, which doesn't involve you actually being naked, but is naked more of a, like a metaphorical term? Yeah. Tell me how you got involved in physiotherapy.
Well, hey, thanks, Hugh, for inviting me on to your podcast. And look, it's a real privilege to be asked to come on and have a chat with you, particularly around the stuff around acceptance and commitment therapy. I'm really excited to sort of delve into that a little bit more later on. I mean, for me, you know, everything that you've said there, in terms of my journey into physiotherapy and then the shift towards sort of a, I guess this sort of bespoke, possibly, hopefully not to upset anyone, slightly bastardized version, and apologies for swearing, but bastardized version on of physiotherapy, in that, you know, I probably have been drawn into psychology a little bit more, and also occupational therapy, because pain management isn't really sport. Mm-hmm. Pain management probably isn't really about treating injuries so much anymore. Pain management is very much about, and not to be cliche and use, I guess, the terminology that's associated with ACT, is to try and support people living with pain to live well.
Yeah.
There isn't a cure. There's no cure for pain. And, and you know, that conjures up this whole question about why would we want a cure for pain? I mean, there's some real philosophical, quite deep questions when it comes to pain. You're absolutely right. My attention, having been in sports therapy for, true goodness, qualified in that in 1998, sort of higher national diploma, went on and did sports rehab at university till 2001. So was working during that time whilst I was studying, and then carried that on. So, you know, it's well over 20 years I've been working in sort of sport therapy and injury rehab and things, and then realized that at the time in the UK, that degree was very new. And it's actually based on the athletic trainer model in the US, the sports rehab program.
Okay.
So it was really hard to get some traction in the UK with that degree. And so, like many people that had been in sports therapy, unless you'd got the lucky break, a lot of them went back and did physiotherapy. Mm. And so that was for me. And having had sort of this, having been in musculoskeletal care and working in sort of basic neuro rehab as a physio assistant, sort of falls prevention, things like that, I wanted to get that behind me so I could have a little bit more of a broader scope than just purely focused on musculoskeletal. Yeah. And I'm really glad I have, because of the direction that I've gone in. And the journey then, obviously, as I say, led me into physio. And honestly, from the first lecture in pain management, you know, there was the standard lectures of anatomy and the standard lectures of, looking at respiratory-based, there were respiratory-based modules and neuro-based modules, etc. and the standard musculoskeletal modules of doing your manual therapy and all this sort of stuff that you do in physio. But the thing that really captured me was the pain management stuff. The lecturer that taught at the time, it just grabbed my attention, because I think there were questions that when I was a sports therapist, I was scratching my head at the time, then going, why is it that some people are getting better doing a treatment approach and some people aren't getting better with the same treatment approach? And often we focus on the ones that do well. We don't necessarily focus on the ones that don't do well. Yeah. You know, we pride ourselves on our successes, and, you know, and you'll notice that I sometimes you might need to rein me in, because I can go off on tangents, because I've always got lots of questions and thoughts going on in my head. But so with regards to pain management, it captured my attention early on. I was drawn in by a lot of the teachings from actually a prolific, if you like, I suppose he kind of was, and still kind of is, a chap called Lorimer Moseley in Australia, who'd come over to the UK, done his PhD in Oxford. And I just started attending some of his courses, his weekend courses on that, because I knew this is what I wanted to do. You know, pain management was what I wanted to do. And I've been referred to as a little bit weird, because pain management is actually quite scary for clinicians as well, because it's complicated, it's complex, and it's complicated, and it's challenging work. And
is that the scary part? Is that the scary part, or dealing or not being able to help the patients the scary part?
Yeah. I think I wonder if that is. I mean, that sounds terrible. It's not that patients are scary. You know that, no, I'm not. I definitely am not saying that. Patients are not scary. It's the challenges that come with it. You know, from a traditional physio perspective, we hone in on tissue.
Yeah.
We do massage. I mean, if there are physios listening to this, they'll completely relate to the old sort of traditional model of looking very tissue based, doing massage mobilizations with this expectation that our hands had these magical healing powers, and that we were fixing tissue and realigning joints and things like that with our manipulation. And of course, a lot of that's been refuted by the research. And so there's a lot of now, in terms of that research base, of course, that's really changing the mindset of a lot of physios. And I guess there is a little bit of that pain-based stuff that's sort of feeding into that, into the traditional physio. But I think from a pain management perspective, it's not just what's going on in tissue. It's, you know, you're having to take a real step back from zooming in on tissue and looking at the much broader perspective of the person and the environment and the context, the environmental context that person interacts with. And how that has an impact on how that person reacts. It's this constant cyclical dynamic process. It's fascinating. And so just from that, it is challenging. Yeah.
Well, and the way I have read it too, is that your field is going through that kind of philosophical change model at basically the same time that our field, behavior analysis, is also going through that kind of shift. Right. Well, more focus on how we learn than what you do is, you know, you focus on chronic pain management, right? Mm. And then what we had talked about is this philosophical shift, that there's a broader context of why a person experiences pain rather than tissue damage.
Yeah.
So that old model of pain equals tissue damage doesn't apply anymore.
That's right.
And you know, when I read that, I was a bit confused, because I had always assumed, it's like, oh well, I mean, if I'm experiencing chronic pain, there's got to be something physically wrong. And how do emotions and your behavioral history, your experiences kind of play into how you interpret pain and how you experience chronic pain?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, we have to, I think it's important to highlight that there's still the sort of distinctions between acute pain, which is very much in the presence of tissue insult, and chronic pain, which is more about a change that's happened within the nervous system. Now, you could technically argue that nerves are still tissue, right? Mm-hmm. So the challenge, of course, is that the underpinning model, the biomedical model, I mean, it underpins medicine, it underpins physio, it underpins it. As my understanding, it even underpins psychology in some respects as well. And so, as I say, the challenges are that despite the fact that you have a acute tissue damage in acute pain, pain in that sense is really important.
Yeah,
you know, pain is very much the motivator to get us to do something, to protect the limb or to move out of harm's way or whatever. At that point of having tissue injury, this, I think what's important to know is that there's still a human attached to that, and that human will always have had a level or period, will always have had a period of development, understanding the meaning that we place upon what's happening to us or what's happening to our body, and in perhaps even in the context that the injury occurred. You know, there's lots of examples where and you look at it from a post-traumatic stress disorder perspective, there's lots of instances that occur that when we move into a particular environmental context and we experience an injury there, then people can experience sensations and that might be similar to that when they first experienced it, when they had the injury. So like road traffic accidents, you know, people report, you know, neck pains and things like that when they go past the area that they had their car accident. Yeah. Some people actually have so much anxiety about it, they have full on, they feel these sort of sensory and emotional and physiological responses that occur when they're exposed to that environmental context. So anxiety and things come out. So the challenge there is that the model, the biomedical model, is specifically looking at what is going on essentially in tissue, and we would refer that to what's called nociception. So nociception is this message that comes from the tissue, if you like, and is delivered by a particular class of nerve, and ultimately that is then transmitted into the nervous system. And so there's this ongoing debate between the differences between what is pain and what is nociception. And often those two things can get confused, because nociception is information, whereas pain is an experience based upon that information.
Good point, yeah.
And not just nociception. It's based upon essentially the overarching word would be meaning. So what we understand and how we understand it and why, and then context. So context is made up of those personal factors, memories, experiences, what we understand, our information from neighbors, family, friends, healthcare professionals, etc. It creates that whole understanding. Yeah. And then environment also has a component in that too. And I would say environment potentially of maybe what's happening inside our body as well as outside our body.
Yeah.
So how our environment inside the body changes. Yeah. So you can see that you can get lost in it quite extensively.
And I see that, because then you can, but it's also exciting too, because I mean, you can narrow down the context of what specific things that you can work on, right, to relieve certain amounts of pain, and then kind of broaden that context of what is your history. You know, it amazed me to read that, you know, people who have experienced child abuse, domestic violence, they have all these histories that were troublesome, mm-hmm. that they tend to experience. There's a correlation with increased chronic pain.
Yeah.
And I also read too, you know, it was fascinating that about 50% of the people who do have tissue damage, right? That you would think, all right, that would be clear across the board that they would be experiencing pain, don't experience pain at all. In fact, and then people with less tissue damage experience far more pain. And that led to, you know, this kind of interpretation.
An interesting point you raise, because, you know, our current medical system, and even the understanding, which is less so now, I think, you know, with the likes of podcasts like this and lots of other podcasts that obviously are coming out, or that have already been released around pain, and all the research and the blogs, etc., and just conversations that people are having around pain, people are beginning to understand that it's probably less about tissue. There's still tissue involvement, but less about it. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're thinking, you know, you're tipping the balance of the scales, if you like, that there's more, it's more about what's happening in terms of our understanding and the meaning we make of certain situations. But that's because that biomedical model, you know, has permeated into healthcare and society, and it's been there for goodness, well over. Let's look at Descartes, Cartesian philosophy. Yeah. What was back in the 1600s? We're talking over 400 years of this model permeating into society, and that being transferred over to generations and generations and generations.
So
it's, you know, you're not going to change it overnight. You're just not. And it's a really hard, when it's so solidified in you, it's a really hard thing to shift. It's a hard concept to shift.
It is. Yeah.
And of course that then also sort of goes back to, you know, this this leaning of healthcare and society into sort of medical imaging and even diagnostics, so diagnostic testing, where we lean heavily into testing or looking for the tissue source that might be the cause of your pain. And you mentioned sort of linear, I can't recall exactly the terms that you used, but it kind of made me think about, well, what you're talking about with regard to the behavioral contextualists that you're part of and that you are, you know, that line of reasoning that you have is very similar, like you said, to physio, from a linear reasoning perspective, where we think, you know, A plus B equals C, and it's just, it's not like that. And you know, there are lots of individuals within, you know, academics, clinicians, even within physiotherapy, and it's great, it's really exciting within physiotherapy that are really investigating philosophy a lot deeper, and looking at how things like causation, almost in some respects, or those deep-seated understanding of causation, how that has essentially affected the way that we work. And by moving away from that, seeing this much broader perspective, like I think, like you can relate to that too.
I certainly can. And when you mentioned cause, because we don't use that word in behavior analysis,
right.
We use functional relationships, right? So
right,
are related in terms of, you know, are they functionally related? That whole causation model is so very hard to kind of move away from, which then leads me to my next question for you is, well, my next two sets of questions, which are related. One, how difficult then is it for clinicians in your field to move from, you know, that rule-governed behavior of, no, this is the way I've been taught, this is the way it works, and we're going to stick with this field. And what you're talking about sounds completely overwhelming. And then, so that leads my second question is, where in the world do you start?
No, you're right. I think if you asked me this question maybe 5-10 years ago, I would have given you a different answer. Mm-hmm. But now I think with the emergence of the likes of social media, and just, you know, small and these podcasts, small little sort of focus groups, people coming together on things like Messenger and stuff like that, you know, conversations are being had. Mm. And so you ask the question, you know, where do we start?
Yeah.
I think that is a question that you shouldn't feel afraid to ask, and don't feel overwhelmed or shy or vulnerable or scared about asking that, because you know what, it's totally okay to do that. Hence me writing something called The Naked Physio. It's that metaphor for that sense of vulnerability in that, I don't know it all, but I'm willing to have the conversations with people in order to get the support and get the, if you like, let's be mechanistic, the tools that I need in order to provide people with workable ways to live well. And that's always the focus here for me in terms of pain management. I don't fix people. I help people learn to live well. People that have been living with pain for a long period of time, you know, they've been around the houses. So for example, Casey's blog, you know, that one of the first subheadings is the medical merry-go-round. Right. And I think a lot of patients, or sorry, I think a lot of people living with chronic pain, they can relate to that medical merry-go-round. So you know what? They've had it. They've been there.
Yeah.
They've done it.
Yeah.
So if you're faced with someone who's living with chronic pain, I think the best thing you can do is be open, be honest, and just say, look, empathize with them. I think is your first approach. I'm so sorry to hear that you've been living with this for so long. What I'd like to do is to be able, is to try and see what things I can help you with. Some of the things you've mentioned, I'm not familiar with, but I know people that I can approach. I know people I can speak to. And you know what? I think just from working with people for well over 15 years in this field, they appreciate that.
Yeah.
They appreciate if a clinician is open and honest and says, you know what, I'm not sure here. And that's, do you know what? And that's okay. That one of the hard things in terms of physio is because of this, you mentioned this sort of what's called this positivist approach is that the doctor knows best, right? Doctor knows best. And that kind of permeated into physio because physio has this very close affinity to medicine. Uh-huh. And so this positivist approach is still sits within physio, but actually you can see the younger generation of physios that are coming through. I mean, goodness me, we have the Environmental Physiotherapy Association now.
Yeah.
There's an amazing guy in Norway. I'll name drop him again. I've name dropped already today, but Philip Maric, you know, this very sort of progressive, innovative, revolutionary approach to physiotherapy where you wouldn't even have thought of going 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But just thinking broader about environment, how climate and environment has a significant impact on people. And right. Again, you know what, this is what I love about ACT is that, you know, from what I understand is that ACT doesn't asks a different question. Mm-hmm. Instead of asking what's the cause of the disease and how does it affect the person, my understanding of ACT and maybe even process-based therapy is what things are affected in the person and how does this contribute to disease?
Yeah.
It flips it round and it asks a completely, it sounds so obvious, but it's really quite novel.
Yeah.
But it's too easy to sort of go, oh, you've got chronic back pain. Right, let's move out from that. And it's too easy to get drawn into that as opposed to, right, okay, you've got chronic back pain. Chronic back pain. Okay, there's your disc. That's what needs to be sorted, the disc.
Right.
Whereas actually, if you look at low back pain, as you say, 50% of people can have disc problems but report no pain.
Right.
You look much broader and go, right, what's your lifestyle like? What's your demographics like? What's the socioeconomics like? What's your health like? What's your interactions with people like? What's your understanding of your body, understanding of healthcare? Yeah. And then that gives you workable ways to sort of try and modify those things. And that helps you determine, because we know this from the evidence base, how that contributes to disease.
Yeah.
So I think to summarize that, having the conversations, I think, is so important for physios.
Yeah.
Like, where do you start? Have the conversations.
Yeah.
And I can lay testament to that. Uh-huh. I did it myself, and I've had a lot of students, new graduates, who, and particularly in my job as well, but even outside of my job, and who contact me on social media, who read my blog, and I say, let's go for a beer. Let's go and have a chat and have a beer.
Good.
You know, and honestly, that I think, you know, and even just that little bit of guidance to sort of say, you know what, here's a good book.
Yeah.
Here's a good paper to read if you want that gives you a generalized understanding of what we're talking about when it comes to pain management.
Yeah, that's what I loved about reading. Well, first, I mean, that's what I loved about when I first met you in that ACT Immersion Facebook group, right? It's like, here's a guy who loves the question. He loves to contribute. You know, he is not shy, you know, is where 98% of the people are really shy. They're real standoffish. So if they have a question, they don't really ask, you know, which is to their own detriment many times. But like, you're not only bold in that, but also how, you know, when I read your blog not only comes off as very informed and very balanced, but very empathetic. Like, you are really, through your words and reaching out, obviously just the whole design of your website is reaching out to the client who is experiencing chronic pain, and it's very obvious how, you know, how the clients have responded to you, that this is what I need. I'm not going to be able to solve or take away your pain. I just want you to know, right? So, and then that's the first thing is, like, I was relieved from that statement. Like, paradoxically, he's telling me something that I'm not really looking for in my mind. I'm looking to get rid of my pain, but he's being honest with me, and that's what I needed at this time. Uh, I appreciate
that. And that's the thing, isn't it? It's, you know, I will openly admit that I do not know all the answers. Yeah. But because of this, that I go back to that positivist reasoning model that we have, is that doctor knows best. And sometimes that's even implicit from society, right? Society, yeah. We associate medical care with, if I've got a healthcare problem, I know I can go and see my doctor and they're going to sort it for me. Mm-hmm. And that often isn't the case. I have people coming to me going, well, you're the expert in chronic pain. I'm like, you're the expert in your body. Mm-hmm. You know your body better than anyone. I'm here to support you, to walk alongside you, to walk behind you if I need to walk in front of you. And that changes at different times as we work through you learning to live better. I don't know all the answers, but I'm not afraid to ask the question. You know what? I don't know that, but you know what? I know people that might, and give me 24 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the thing. And often it's phrased in a way, mm-hmm. that you're not overly familiar with, and you go and speak to a colleague, and the colleague goes, I think what that is it's this, and you're like, oh, I would have said it that way. So that's really, and right. Then you go back, you have a conversation, and you reflect. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, or no. And if they say no, they go, actually, what I meant was this. And so, of course, that comes into this whole approach of sort of using communication to help guide your reasoning. When it came to Casey's story, that hasn't worked every time. Yeah. I'll let you know. Yeah. You know, always coming up with, look, I'm going to be open and honest. I'm not going to fix your problem. Yeah. People have walked away from me and gone, oh, that's not what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, what is it? I'm sorry. I'm going to totally butcher this, but there's a quote from like Michael Jordan. He's like, isn't it like 50 of the hoops you miss, like the next, I don't know, the next 20 that you get or something like that. You know, you have to make mistakes in order to learn.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're okay with that, and you phrase it in your communication in a way that says that you're open and honest and compassionate, then I think people appreciate that. They know. Well, I had someone in my pain group the other day, right, saying when people ask me, hey, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And they go, do you know what? I'm not doing well. And then they go, you'll be all right. It's like, I hate that. And I'm not surprised to hear it. I know I'll be all right. Of course, I know I'll be all right. You know, but I think because people don't know what to say and how to say, and it's hard, and actually being having empathy is actually, it's a very, very difficult skill to have. It's taken me a long time to learn that. So coming back to Casey's story, I attempt to do it with empathy. Mm-hmm. I tie that into my communication. It's very much about being open, listening, and being empathic. And then in that situation with her, was very much, look, I don't think I can fix it. But the other thing is as well, I suspect that she had the previous medical professionals before her would go, I know what's wrong with you. This is what you need.
This is what you need.
And it wasn't, every time you go, okay, and it didn't work, that almost knocks you down a rung in the ladder. You meet someone, I know what you need. And you go, okay, maybe, and that lifts you up half a rung, and then it doesn't, and then it knocks you down another rung. So you're much deeper down than what you were when you first started out getting your treatment.
Yeah.
Because you're questioning yourself as well.
It brings up an important point to me too, that we think along the lines so mechanistically, right? That mm-hmm. that there is a perfect next thing to say, and I better say it, right? I had watched a clinician in action. I'll give you a good example. PhD, and he was talking with a real client about chronic pain. He was saying all the right things, but he was lacking that quality, that kind of like undefinable quality of connection, you know? So the patient was telling him things that he thought he wanted to hear, very possibly, right? It's not so much of knowing what the next thing or making mistake or concentrating on that. It's how do you then engage with that flow?
Yeah.
That you're either in it or you're not, you know, that you're either connecting or you're not connecting. It's not about all the right things.
Mm. Yeah. I can very much relate to that. An example, a good couple of years back where, you know, one of the things that is associated with physiotherapy is when we learn a new skill and a new tool, we jump onto this bandwagon and we think that that's the be all and the end all of all people's problems. And so I recall a client coming in to see me with a long history of back pain and repeat surgeries, and this expectation from me to take her through a particular rehab approach. And of course I said, no, I don't think that's what you need. I think this is what you need. Mm-hmm. And the response was, the last 10 physios that I've seen have said all the same thing. You're saying something different. Why should I trust you? Mm-hmm. And I knew at that point I'd lost her. Mm-hmm. Because there's a, you know, but that was a huge learning experience for me. That's mm-hmm. about learning to read the room. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
This ability and skill of being able to read the room.
Yes.
Is so important.
Definitely a skill. In that situation then, when you're realizing that you're losing her, what do you do to recover that? Do you address it right then and there? It's like, I feel like I'm losing you right now. Let's talk about that.
I mean, I think I guess I'm the kind of person that is quite open to apologizing, saying sorry. You know, I think I feel I may have said the wrong thing there. As you say, I get the sense that I'm losing you here. Mm. In that situation, mm-hmm. I stepped back and I recall, I think I said, okay, I think I said, I feel that's not what you wanted to hear. Mm. Are you happy to tell me what you need? Mm-hmm. And she was very open with that. She said, this is what I need. And I said, okay, let's work on that. Mm-hmm. And are you happy for me to sort of share knowledge with you as we go along? It turned out that there were a lot of things going on in her life that she needed to get on top of. Mm-hmm. from a psychological perspective, and we ended up prioritizing that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The physiotherapy wasn't right for her at that moment in time, but I still, you know, I still, it's funny because that mentioning that clear, that still affects me because mm-hmm. that's quite ingrained in here in terms of an experience that I go, hang on, that has helped to shape how I communicate, or that one experience has helped to shape how I communicate and how I learn to read the room.
Good.
So even though it didn't quite turn out well, it's actually helped long term.
Very good.
And I think that's also helped to sort of, it helped me to sort of, you know, that's one of the reasons I write my blog. It's cathartic, right?
Yeah.
It's thinking. Writing is thinking as well, and it allows you to consolidate your thoughts. And I often go back to my blog and read through things and go, geez, did I write that? Wow, that like, and I know that sounds really some possibly egotistical, but I do actually go back through my blogs and go, geez, did I write that? Because I can relate to that in a situation that I've just had the other day. Or, you know, I might go back and go, God, did I write that? Oh, I need to change that. Uh-huh. I find it so helpful from that perspective. The reason I wrote my blog purely for selfish reasons, for that cathartic reason of trying to put things down, learn, read back through, and then, you know, and at the end of the day, if I share it with other people and they relate to it and it resonates with them and it creates conversation between people or between clinicians, then I think that's an added bonus.
Excellent. So, I really like reading it, and I wanted to kind of end when we're talking about pain is like where we go from here and what kind of taking off. You know, we set the stage of they come into the room, and you try to understand the context of the situation. I mean, understand the full history and the scope and with kind of kindness and empathy. Where do you normally take what are good available kind of general treatments for chronic pain? And, you know, and before you answer that question, please define for us what chronic pain is, because I think that we glossed over that.
That is a good question. Chronic pain is chronic pain from a simplistic perspective. It's got a definition, and pain has a definition. If you look up the International Association for the Study of Pain, mm-hmm. The definition there is that pain is a emotional and sensory experience, and I'm gonna probably get this completely wrong, but it's based upon actual or potential tissue damage or aversive stimuli that are specific to the person. So I know I haven't got that definition correct, exactly textbook. Chronic pain is, as I say, less about tissue damage. It's kind of based upon, I think the simplest definition of chronic pain is that pain that lasts longer than 3 months.
Okay. All right.
Because beyond the 3 month time frame, see, this is where things become, for me, they become gray, right? Yeah. Because the standard definition, of course, is that pain that lasts longer than 3 months, because the argument is that within 3 months your tissues have healed. But the argument back against that is if you've got someone who has very poor health choices, yeah, and there are a host of, say, pre-morbid factors, like there's a chronic smoker, chronic drinker, yeah, they don't get any exercise, they eat unhealthily, you know, that time frame can last longer. That's where delayed healing occurs, yeah, etc. And of course, those pre-morbid factors also predispose people to having more of a, if you like, from a physiological state, a more inflammatory state within, yeah, their body. So there are those factors that can feed into someone's perpetuation of pain. So simple, very straightforward answer is chronic pain is pain that lasts longer than 3 months.
Okay, all right.
But it's a multidimensional experience. There are multidimensional, yeah, factors that feed into this.
It's not as simplistic as just saying, I have pain that's lasted longer than 3 months, so.
Yeah. Just for your listeners, if they're interested, if you type in René Descartes model of pain on Google, uh-huh, you'll see a young child with his foot in the fire, and then a cord that runs up his leg, up his back, and then there's a bell in his brain. And the idea is that there's the mind-body split, in that the fire pulls on the cord and rings the bell in the brain to alert us to pain in the foot. What you don't see is the behavioral response of the child. You don't see family members around the child and how they respond to the foot in the fire. You don't see the after effects of what occurred as a result of the foot in the fire.
You don't see the child's history.
Exactly. And so it gives a very, like you say, a very simplistic understanding of what pain is. And of course, we know from now since Melzack and Wall back in 1965, Melzack and Wall who founded Paingate theory, it's broadened up. It's exploded since then. You know, the last 40, 50, 60 odd years.
We've really
seen a huge emergence in our understanding of pain, but there's still a long way to go. There's such a long way to go.
Yeah.
But you say, so general treatments.
Yeah.
Well, from my perspective in terms of, I'm going to be quite broad with this. Because I think working in pain management, it's not just, you know, what I'm hoping that listeners to this podcast will have realized as well, or have maybe even reflected on, is that, you know, it's not about siloed based care. The physio just does his physio bit. The OT just does their OT bit. The psych just does their psych bit.
Yeah.
There should be this interdisciplinary, cross-pollinatory sort of approach between these disciplines. And so I'm comfortable in the presence of, within that pain umbrella, to have treatment conversations, if you like, around emotion, around beliefs, around workable ways from a communication perspective to get people going again. But I want to drop back in time a little bit, back to Bill Fordyce, who's a little bit of a number of clinicians, and I'm talking across the scope from physios, OTs, psychs, etc. You know, he's a little bit of a pioneer when it comes to healthcare and behavioral approaches within healthcare. You know, he has a saying that says, for behavior change, information is like wet noodles to a brick. So the wet noodles, they'll stick to the brick and then they'll fall off. They don't penetrate through the brick. And so what he's essentially saying is, his communication is great, but in order for people to really understand and learn, they've got to live it, they've got to do it, they've got to live it. And to me, that's OT and physio to a T. It's practical, it's doing, it's getting people to experience those things, to help consolidate and solidify their learning. And so, you know, you use exposure-based approaches to be fair, things like exercise actually has been shown to be, if we look at the evidence base, there isn't actually a lot that separates out the likes of exercise, CBT, and ACT from that perspective. The only thing is that CBT, and I would say exercise, they've been researched quite extensively for quite a long time, you know, plus 50 odd years.
Yeah.
ACT is only about 30, 40 years. It's still relatively young. But for ACT to be able to hold its ground on CBT and exercise, I think for me, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's a fairly new, novel approach, even though it's, you know, it's derived from behavioral reactivation. It's derived from first wave and second wave psychology.
Yeah.
You know, it still holds its own. And to be able to then go, you know, not jump onto the bandwagon, well, ACT is the new thing. Whoa. You know, why not bring a little bit of exercise Why not bring a little bit of CBT? Why not do a little bit of ACT? Why not do a little bit of hands-on stuff? The power of touch is amazing from a physiological response. I'll give you an example I use with some of my clinicians, my new clinicians that are learning about pain and the students and things. I give them this, unfortunately, it's quite a creepy example. If I'm chatting to a colleague, you know, and I might say, so for example, let's say, your partner, you're telling me about a difficult situation, right? And your partner goes, oh, you know, darling or whatever, I'm really sorry to hear that. And they put a reassuring rub on your shoulder. If you told me that same situation and I went, oh, darling, like that, you'd probably go, ooh, that's creepy. Whereas their partner, they'd be like, oh, yeah, that's what I need.
Right.
I need that comfort. Whereas if I did it, a stranger, they'd be like, ooh, that's just creepy. But the physical sensation is exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
The physical touch is exactly the same. The physiological response and the emotional response and the thought processes behind it are completely different.
Yeah.
And that's some of the challenges behind pain as well. You know, the physical sensory experience of pain is so profound that someone, you know, it does not surprise me that someone goes, there's something here. It's got to be here. Yeah. There's something wrong here.
Yeah.
You know, it's so profound. And so provocative.
Yeah.
But that example there that I just gave is that physical feeling can be interpreted in a very different way based upon physiology, emotion, thought, context, whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
to me, that sums it up pain. From my level of understanding, my colleagues, they have they go the next level in almost into sort of consciousness and things like that. I'm trying to understand that, but sort of from there, where I'm at.
Yeah. Well, and it occurs to me too, it doesn't matter what your colleagues are doing. What does it work? Does it work with your particular client? What you're doing in that situation, is that working? And then, and is that moving them, identifying them, moving in that right direction in the small, identifiable steps, you know, so not getting rid of the pain, but they feel like they're moving and now they can identify those movements, real positive. I think that I feel like we can talk about this all day.
We just don't have that.
But you had mentioned just quickly about ACT, and you know, ACT has only been around for 30 or 40 years or so. And I think of ACT as more of a kind of a framework from which we can actually adapt how we work, you know, and then those six core processes of when you're sitting down with a client. And you know, he or she says something, you're talking about, ooh, you know, this sounds a bit of a fusion here. You know, let's tackle that. So it kind of allows you that, ooh, I'm going to bring that into from this context and tackle that, right? Just sit with that for a while and then kind of broaden that out and identify where are their strong points. It's just so useful. But I think that, you know, there's a difference between knowing it. Like I can tell you I know, but applying it is a very, very different repertoire, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's missed a lot of the times is applying it is very, it's a skill in and of itself.
I think you're right, because the challenge, of course, is that you can apply that same mechanistic level of thinking into ACT. So for example, diffusion, you said, as an example, you could look up, you know, in your big book of ACT metaphors around diffusion techniques, and you just go, right, this is what you need to do. Do it like this.
You're right.
You know? And it's so it's very so it's, it becomes didactic and it becomes very mechanistic.
And at that point, you're losing. You're just lost that connection. You know.
Correct. Yeah. And I think and the thing is that you can look at ACT. You can look at ACT as a very as an a wonderfully revolutionary approach to treatment. But you know what? There's so much more, actually, that's still needed. That ability to be able to empathize, that ability to be able to connect, like you say, that ability to be able to communicate, that ability to be able to be in this dynamic interrelationship.
And as you said, read the room, be able to read the room, you know, and not only like what they say, but, you know, the looks that they give you, or are they turning away, or are they grimacing, or thinking, paying attention to those kind of contextual cues that you can pick up and say, well, let's, you know, wait a second. That takes skill. That takes a lot of practice. And I'm telling you, it's something that it could be a lifetime endeavor.
Yeah.
Never become a ninja at it. So, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Man, I appreciate talking with you today. I really do. I as I said, I think we can go on for another hour and talk about this. It's fascinating because it's very layered.
It really is. Hey, actually, just having a chat with you and seeing how you're right, how layered this whole thing is.
Sure is. Yeah. Listen, I want before we go though, I do want to ask you point out some this. Totally off the subject, but New Zealand facts.
And, right.
Because I thought,
oh my goodness. Really,
New Zealand, you're halfway around the world. I want to take the opportunity to, probably most of our listeners will not be from New Zealand, most likely, because New Zealand only has, what, 4.5 million?
We've hit five.
Oh, 5 million. Okay. Yeah. We've so still a fraction. You have more sheep than you have people, my understanding.
Have you read, you're probably right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So we had mentioned this before. Coldest month of the year?
Is July. June through August,
Okay, so and then what way does your toilets flush?
Oh no.
I've heard this is all a myth. Right?
Is it
a myth?
To me, that is not a thing. And do you know what? I may have paid attention to it once, but I'd forgotten. By the time I had gotten to New Zealand, I'd forgotten what way the toilet flushes in the UK. So it's just not a thing.
Well, Neil deGrasse, I can tell you, I always thought that it was a real thing. They moved in the opposite. They moved, I think, clockwise. But then Neil deGrasse Tyson said, no, that's a myth. The Coriolis effect has really no kind of influence on this small matter of a toilet. So it moves in the direction of the toilet is designed, basically.
Yeah. If Neil deGrasse Tyson says it, I'm not going to argue with him. So,
but you know, so your population is only 5% human, my understanding. Mm-hmm. You have the southernmost capital of anywhere in the world, which is Wellington.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Yes, we will. Yes, no, you're right, we will.
You are, New Zealand is the first in women's rights. In 1893, got the right to vote.
Yeah.
It's larger than the UK, but 1/14 of the population.
That's right,
And of course, what's the famous trilogy? Brought $200 million to your economy.
I hope Lord of the Rings. I hope Lord of the Rings isn't the thing that defines New Zealand.
Man, I think it's the beauty. It just looks tremendous there. And
I mean, you know, if you've watched the Lord of the Rings movies, you know how a lot of movies nowadays are messed up by CGI. I mean, that, honestly, that's not CGI.
Yeah.
That's genuinely what the landscape looks like. And the colors of the water, that genuinely, that's what it looks like. It's stunning.
Yeah. So I appreciate it. Thank you. And we'll stay in touch.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Hugh. Thanks again for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You bet. All right. Cheers. Take care.
Cheers.
All right. Bye.